You want to see something really scary?
You bet.
Really?
Yeah. Okay, this is really, really scary now. Scare me.
Are you ready?
Okay, go ahead.
Cornucopia Radio presents...
This special Halloween edition of the Cornucopia Radio Show contains drama, music, and comedy, which some people may find disturbing or distasteful. If you're unsure, please detune your radio.
For the record, the time is 10:32 at Sheffield East Police Station, DCI Carpenter attending. So far, the interview subject has not given out his name and was found wandering in the city centre wearing only a strange metallic silver suit. He has refused the offer of a state-supplied lawyer and keeps insisting he talks to the people. Interview commencing.
Hello, my name is DCI Robert Carpenter. Can we first start by having your own name, please?
Unfortunately, my true name would be impossible for you to pronounce or write. Also, considering the amount of time we have, I feel it would only serve as a distraction. I hope you are happy to continue this conversation without the need for one.
Well, it would make filling out this paperwork a little easier.
If you must, then you may call me Regulon.
Why Regulon?
It is an element your race has not yet discovered. An element whose properties my race most closely resembles.
Your race? I take it by this you're suggesting you're not of this planet. Because I've got to say, you look quite human to me. It's been a long night, okay? Can you just tell me your name or address and we can all go home?
Do not underestimate the advancement of my race. This is merely a living exosuit that allows me to project my essence across the transspatial pathways. My true form exists in my home dimension, where others are also monitoring this situation.
Ah, so you're not from another planet, just another dimension. Do you really expect me to believe that?
I don't expect anything of you. My only purpose here is to debrief you and your people of the situation and the end of this experiment. We are led to believe that your kind would describe it as pruning the branches.
What do you mean?
Let me begin by saying that, as a member of an intelligent species far superior to your own, I am previewed to a large array of interstellar social parameters. Before my journey to Earth, it was decided that the most appropriate course of action would be to explain the situation to the entire human race. In this task, I have already begun the transmission of this interview to every broadcasting device on the planet via a frequency this exosuit emits naturally.
Can I get you a drink? You know, some kind of coffee, perhaps? You sound like you really need a coffee.
It all began when my race strived to create the most advanced intelligence known to our galaxy. My predecessor was the leading expert in the field of biomechanics and founded the institute I now lead. He discovered a way to create life from the mixing of two elements he himself had designed. These two elements, when combined, would create climate, seas, and most importantly, bacteria. Combining those elements on millions of desolate, barren planets, my predecessor witnessed the spark that created every world. Those bacteria evolved to form the many life forms that now inhabit every planet, and on each one, it was the humans that prevailed to become the most intelligent of all species.
You should write some of this stuff down. Make a great story.
You joke. But even with your slow, primitive brain, it is surely not beyond you to understand how many of these worlds might fail.
Fail? What are you talking about?
We have seen the wars, the tyranny, and the death on your planet. This was not meant to be. You all know this. The worlds we create are not meant to exist in this state. Individual failures must not be allowed to compromise the entire experiment. Branches must be pruned.
Oh, it's Halloween, isn't it? They must always come out on Halloween.
All the algorithmic and biometric tests we have run have deduced that the advancement of this planet has come to a conclusive and definitive halt. Therefore, this exosuit will now commence its own self-destruction program as the only known solution to this problem. The improved Project God will continue uninterrupted with the removal of this world. Prepare for the end.
Oh, Utopia Broadcasting, and this is Halloween.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
Welcome to a night of total terror.
Hello, I'm Gary Greenwald, and over the past several years, the Eagle's Nest Ministries has exposed certain things like rock and roll music, Dungeons and Dragons, marijuana, and even the New Age movement. And now we feel there's another attack upon our society.
I went into the internet to just typed in teen witches, Halloween. There were over 50,000 sites on Halloween and teaching teens how they could get involved in Wicca, how to do hexes, cast spells, tarot card reading, where they could get the witch's Bible from, holy days such as Halloween or Samhain, as it really is known within the pagan world.
To avoid fainting, keep repeating,
it's only a movie, only a movie.
Well, I believe that it's a direct depiction of Satan and his demon powers and demon friends.
Of course, we have television and the movies that are making horror films and Halloween films more and more acceptable during this particular holiday. I mean, everything's geared to Halloween-type entertainment. We get horror houses, a lot of stuff, in a sense, making death not seem so sinister, making communication with the death not so sinister.
Fight.
Young boys and ghouls in ghoulish disguise, they cover the skin, conceal their eyes.
A great mistake to be held when the ghosts are about. It's Halloween,
a time to be on the rest of the world. They don't observe this ash which has become our biggest concern.
That the allows Chad Peru. We need their help or else we're through.
They don't know the fear we endure once a year.
Soon consume them all.
Then everyone will understand the truth.
pure terror.
Stinks of disintegration and decay. The earth is dirty. The sea is dirty. The heavens rain slush. We are already in hell.
The night air was cold, and as I rang the doorbell and stood there waiting, I started thinking about how crazy this all was. We had only ever spoken by email, but still, our conversations had grown quite hot and heavy during that time, and it was obvious she wanted the same thing I did. Despite this, I was still nervous. Maybe I should have told somebody where I was going tonight. These internet dating sites always seem to recommend things like that. However, all those thoughts quickly left my mind as she opened the door, smiled at me, and walked back inside, leaving the way open. "You're late," Sally stated. I quickly followed her back to the kitchen. She handed me a drink. I didn't know what to say, so I just stood there and drank deep from the glass. It tasted a little funny, a little bitter, but I continued to drink. After a few seconds of just staring at me, she spoke. "You need to get out of those clothes for a start. Then I can see what I've got to work with," she stated with a wide grin. I swallowed the last of the drink and took a deep breath. "What?" I asked. "This is your idea," she said. "I'm willing to go along with it, but you can't go all coy on me about it now. You need to shut up if you want this to happen." I quickly closed my mouth and began to remove my clothes. She watched as I removed each piece nervously. I felt degraded, but hoped that it would be worth it later. "Put them there and fold them up neatly. I don't want to touch them." She pointed to a box on the kitchen table. After doing as she requested, I turned back to her and waited. She stared at me for a moment, and then signalled me to come with her finger as she backed down the hallway. It was getting hotter in the house, and I started feeling warm and strangely tired. I realised I had to shake this off quickly. It looked like I was about to have a lot of fun, and I couldn't fall asleep, not at a time like this. "Hurry, dear," she said, urging me into the bedroom. But by the time I made it to the doorway, I was almost falling. I braced myself against the door and leaned in. The room seemed empty but for a single sheet of plastic on the floor and what looked like bandages draped in the centre. What was she planning? As I started into the room, I felt myself spinning and she quickly caught me just before I fell, slowly guiding me down to the floor, laying me on the gauze in the centre. I quickly lost consciousness and everything went black. When I opened my eyes, I found myself totally wrapped head to toe in gauze. She had put something gooey into the bandages as well. It seemed to be some kind of dough. I wanted to scream for help, but I wasn't able to speak. There was something in my mouth, perhaps a gag, but I suspected it was more likely to be another wad of dough. I squirmed a little and tried to feel around for what else was going on, when suddenly I heard her voice from the corner. "At last! My little sausage roll is awake," said Sally, delighted to see me conscious. "I can finally start stuffing your insides with the filling." Her enthusiasm was starting to frighten me. I didn't want to be stuffed with anything. "You're going to get the protein paste injected into your body first, and shortly after, you'll be ready for ginger," she said sprightly. "Oh, and don't worry. I've made you just the right amount for your intestines. You won't feel too bad, I promise." She left the room and returned carrying a large plastic bag full of what must have been the protein paste that she spoke of. She hooked it up to the wall near my feet and left the room again, returning with a large tube. She hooked the tube up to the receptacle under my rear and then placed the other end up to the bag, clamping it on tight. I saw the paste slowly making its way down the long tube towards my body. Fear gripped me as I realised it would soon push into my ass and make its way into my guts. Having no way to move, all I could do was sit and wait. Sally sat on a chair dispassionately watching me as the liquid made its way down. I was feeling completely helpless as the first bit of paste slowly started to press into me. It was slow, but thick and seemed to take forever. I started feeling tighter inside the wrappings as the paste swelled inside me. My gut was growing, stretching. After an hour, Sally left the room and returned with yet another bag. I was petrified beyond belief. "Now this one goes down into your stomach and will fill the opposite side of your insides. It's also going to absorb all your nasty stomach juices and make you more digestive friendly for ginger," Sally explained calmly. What was going to happen to me? And who or what was ginger? Why did I need to be more digestive friendly? Was I going to be food? Food for what? Sally fed another tube through the door in my mouth. I felt it hit the back of my throat and gagged as she pushed it deeper into my esophagus, eventually settling itself into my stomach. Even as the other bag was close to finishing, this new bag at my head was just beginning. There was a grey colour to the paste, and I watched the mixture slide down the tube and into my mouth, passing within inches of my eyes, going slowly down into my stomach. "I made it myself. It's a mix of whey protein, cornmeal, egg whites, broccoli and vitamin mix. I start off by wrapping smaller animals, you know, rats, guinea pigs, and then finally larger animals like pigs, so you aren't so different," she said proudly. "I've also got one other thing you'll appreciate. It's a bone softener. Takes about an hour to fully work, but it'll make your last moments much more relaxing. I got it from a guy I met in South America, not so far from where I found ginger." She brought a pouch of what looked like saline into the room and hooked it into an IV that was already in my arm. It burned going in and seemed to sting every inch of my body. It was bad enough that the paste in my stomach was almost full and cutting off my breathing, but now this bone softener was doing something else. I felt my hips go limp, and all at once I felt my entire body slump into itself as the growing pace pushed my soft bones out of the way. My entire body went numb. I felt nothing. Nothing but the pace moving around inside me. She started dragging me out of the room and into the hall, struggling to get me to move. When she reached the last room along the corridor, she opened the door and pushed me inside before locking the door and leaving me alone. It was quiet and dark. However, I could smell something foul in the air. Something animal. Something not human. What exactly did she have in here with me? I couldn't move anything. Every one of my muscles had completely shut down. I was nothing but a flesh-covered ball of paste. It was then that I heard the side door slide open and saw beyond it into another whole room. In this room, I could just about make out some kind of shape moving in the darkness. It took a while until I could make out what it was, but eventually, it became clear. It was a snake. A giant snake. With this realization, my fate was sealed. I was snake food. The snake didn't come near me for the first hour. I just laid there, waiting for it to get closer. After some time, the snake started circling my body, rubbing closer to my cocoon, feeling my warmth. It was about 30 to 40 inches round its center and at least 10 meters in length, easily big enough to finish me off. Eventually, the snake finally decided to start its dinner. It lifted my ankles and started sliding under me, circling three more times around my body, lifting me up and moving me, as it did, dragging me back into its lair. It started getting tighter around my body, squeezing me firmly. The paste inside me began to slosh up and down my body cavity as the pressure moved to different parts of my cocoon. I gagged as it began squeezing tighter still, and I knew it was about to swallow me. I felt the pressure at my feet as it unlocked its jaw around my calves. It slowly worked me forward into its mouth, walking its jaws up my legs. It then slowly went over my thighs as it constricted on my feet, and I felt myself being pulled powerfully downward. I was living a waking nightmare, and I prayed to be put out of my misery, out of my torture. Soon, Ginger was up to my stomach as the paste inside my body started bulging upwards and I felt my chest and neck swell. Ginger's jaw opened even wider and topped the bulge, leveling out instantly. Quickly, I slid in up to my neck. This was it, I thought. One or two more contractions, and I was done for. It seemed like such a long time, but it probably only took a second. Ginger contracted on me, and I slid deeper under its nose. Once my head was in her mouth, I started feeling the dribbles of its breath on my head. Another contraction, and I was in the dark. Ginger closed her mouth, and I felt the contraction starting again, pulling me deeper, the muscles of her stomach tightly pressing into my face. I was starving for air. I couldn't breathe. I felt the muscles squeezing tighter and tighter as I was pulled deeper and deeper, and then nothing. Sally picked up the box of clothes and carried them to the fireplace, throwing them onto the hot coals. Returning to the viewing room, she looked through the window into Ginger's lair and smiled. Ginger was the best pet Sally had ever owned, and she'd do anything to make her happy. Anything.
As you have heard me say on this telecast many times, there is a spiritual war in this nation for the souls of our children.
Sanguis minimus.
Halloween is a potential doorway. Children become desensitized to the horrors. They become desensitized to the fear attached to death. Think of that night where so many people are terrified of being in their homes. I mean, they lock their houses, close up their doors, and don't even want to be home at this night.
Absinthe is now my only vice and my last remaining pleasure. How sweet life can be when the misery of one's existence is blurred by a slight intoxication. It brings some joy to this long and boring walk through the shadowland of memory. You come here often?
Oh, Dracula. Strindberg, Dracula.
I'm Strindberg. August Strindberg. And this is healing. I had forgotten that a female saint is, after all, a woman. That is to say, man's enemy.
Women.
Delicious homemade jams and jellies, the best in the village. Guaranteed fresh, £3.50 per jar.
Mrs. Milner, are you here? It was unusual to find the village jelly lady not at the counter. I'd come for my weekly jar of strawberry jam during my evening walk. Without an answer, I began to wonder if the old woman was eating dinner in the back of the shop.
Coming, dearie?
The sweet old crone's voice called out. She appeared in the doorway, coming upstairs from what I presumed was the storage room.
The usual this week.
One jar of strawberry, please. I fished the £2 in change from my pocket and placed it on the counter. She looked at me and frowned.
I'm sorry, but it's going to be £3.50 this week. The price of jars went up again, I'm afraid.
I pulled a few coins that I'd been saving from my other pocket and added them to the rest. It's worth it, I said. You make the best jam I've ever had. It's just sweet enough and not too tart. What's your secret? I asked her this every week, and she always gave me the same answer.
It's an old family recipe.
But tonight she surprised me.
How'd you like to see how it's done?
Are you serious? Sure. I probably came across a little over-enthusiastic, but I didn't care. I was finally going to learn the Milner family jam secret. She locked the front door, hung up the closed sign, and gestured for me to follow her downstairs. The basement turned out to be part storeroom and part production facility. The south wall was covered by shelves, stocked to the brim with all kinds of jams and jellies, each labelled with the type of fruit within. On the north wall was a table loaded with fruit presses, juicers, empty jars, and other production tools. Mrs. Milner took great pride in identifying each and every one of them, giving me a little history lesson on where and when she'd acquired the tools. The east wall was taken up by bins of fresh fruits, apples, blueberries and strawberries. She reached into a bin and pulled out an apple.
"Free with every purchase,"
she said, handing it to me. I thanked her and bit into it.
"I grow all my own ingredients in the garden. Nothing goes into my jams and jellies without my personal inspection and approval."
"What's in there?" I asked, as I pointed to the steel door on the west wall.
"Oh, that's where I keep the sweetener."
"A whole room just for sugar?"
"No, I don't use sugar. It's too much trouble to make."
"Then how do you sweeten the jams?" She unlocked the door and said,
"Have a look for yourself."
I stepped inside the dark room. I couldn't see a thing, but I did hear a faint buzzing coming from all around me. "What's that noise?"
"Bees."
"Bees?"
"They make such delicious honey. It's much easier to sweeten the jams with honey, you know."
"I guess it must be pretty cheap if you make the honey yourself." I turned to go back to the basement proper, but found the door closing with a metallic clank.
Miss Milner, open the door. I'm still in here."
"The honey is cheap, yes. But the expensive part is keeping them fed. Do you know how much it costs to raise enough flowers to feed a room full of bees? I'm so glad you came in tonight. You're going to help cut my costs, and then I can go back to selling my jams and jellies for only £2 each."
I beat on the door, ramming it with my shoulder and giving it a series of good kicks.
"Open this door, you crazy old bat."
"Such rudeness,"
I heard her say.
"I hope my bees find you sweeter than I do."
Then came a series of metal clangs, most likely the sound of little crate doors opening in the darkness. The buzzing grew louder, filling the room with a reverberating hum.
Delicious homemade jams and jellies. The best in the village. Guaranteed fresh. £2 per jar.
"A peculiar thing happened to me this morning, Helium. Just as I reached into my pocket to find it empty of any sow, I saw two broken twigs on the ground, shaped like the Greek letters F and S. F and S, Helium, F and S. These are the chemical symbols for iron and sulfur. It was a sign, I'm sure, for me to make gold from these two elements. I have been working all day over these hellish flames. My chopped hands have become poisoned.
Poison!
They are black and bleeding.
Poison!
Black as is my need, bleeding as is my heart.
Bleeding.
The agony becomes intolerable.
The strength of the vampire is that people will not believe in him.
Somewhere in Transylvania, Dracula the monster lies sleeping in his coffin, waiting for night to fall. as exposure to the sun's rays would surely cause him to perish, he stays protected in the satin-lined chamber bearing his family name in silver. Then the moment of darkness comes, and through some miraculous instinct, the fiend emerges from the safety of his hiding place, and, assuming the hideous forms of the bat or the wolf, he prowls the countryside, drinking the blood of his victims. Finally, before the first rays of his arch-enemy the sun announce a new day, he hurries back to the safety of his hidden coffin and sleeps as the cycle begins anew. Now he starts to stir. The fluttering of his eyelids are a response to some age-old, unexplainable instinct. The sun is nearly down and his time is near. Tonight he is particularly hungry. And as he lies there, fully awake now, in red-lined cape and tails, waiting to feel with uncanny perception the precise moment of darkness before opening the lid and emerging, he decides who this evening's victims will be. The baker and his wife, he thinks to himself. Succulent, available, and unsuspecting. The thought of the unwary couple whose trust he has carefully cultivated excites his bloodlust to a fever pitch, and he can barely hold back these last seconds before climbing out of his coffin to seek his prey. Suddenly he knows the sun is down. Like an angel of hell, he rises swiftly and, changing into a bat, flies straight to the cottage of his tantalizing victims.
Why, Count Dracula, what a nice surprise. Come in, come in. What brings you here so early?
Our dinner date. I hope I haven't made an error. You did invite me for tonight, didn't you? I must say I do so enjoy a good bite of food.
Aye, tonight. But that's not for 7 hours yet.
Sorry, what was that?
Or did you come by to watch the eclipse with us?
The eclipse?
Aye. Today's the day of the total eclipse.
What?
A few moments of darkness from noon until 2 minutes after. Look out the window.
Uh-oh, I'm in big trouble.
Eh?
Now, if you'll excuse me...
What's wrong, Count Dracula?
I must be going. Oh, God.
Going? You just came.
Yes, but I think I might have misjudged things a little.
Count Dracula, you're looking a little pale.
Am I? Well, perhaps I need a little fresh air. It was nice seeing you.
Come, sit down. We'll have a drink.
A drink? No. I must run. If you don't mind, you're stepping on my cape?
Relax. Some wine, perhaps?
Wine? No. Gave it up. Liver and all that, you know. And I really must buzz off. I just remembered, I left the lights on at the castle, and the bills will be enormous.
Please, you're not intruding. Don't be so polite. So you're early. So what?
Well, really, I'd like to stay, but there's a meeting of the old Romanian counts across town, and I'm responsible for the cold cuts.
Rush, rush, rush. It's all you ever do. It's a wonder you don't have a heart attack.
Yes, right. And now I must...
Is that the Count?
Count Dracula. You remember my wife, don't you?
Yes, whatever. But I really should...
I'm making chicken casserole tonight. I do hope you like it. You are a little early, though. Have you come to watch the eclipse with us?
I've already asked him that, dear.
Wonderful. Now, if you'll excuse me.
The Count means to leave with a smile as he pushes the baker's wife aside into some laundry. Then, opening a closet door by mistake, he walks in.
Christ, where's the goddamn front door?
Oh, you're such a funny man, Count.
Yes, I knew you'd like that one. The old walking through the wrong door by mistake. But now I really must make my real goodbyes.
Oh, look, dear. The eclipse must be over. The sun's coming out again.
Right. I've decided to stay. Pull down the window shades. Quickly, quickly, move it.
What window shades?
You've got no window shades. Really? Figures. Okay, have you got a basement in this place?
No, I'm always telling him to build one, but he never listens.
Okay, time to panic. Where's that closet again?
You did that one already, Count Dracula. It was most hilarious.
Ah, yes, such a funny man, the Count.
Look, I'll be in the closet. Knock at 7:30.
Oh, he's so funny. He cracks me up.
Oh, Count, come out of the closet. Stop being a big silly.
Can't. Please take my word for it. Just let me stay here. I'm fine, really.
Count Dracula, stop the fooling. We're already helpless with laughter.
Yeah, I know. It seems strange, but yet here I am, having a ball. I was just saying to Mrs. Hess the other day, give me a good closet, and I can stand in it for hours. Sweet woman, Mrs. Hess. Fat, but sweet. Now, why don't you run along and check back with me at sunset?
As luck would have it, the Lord Mayor happens upon the scene. He was passing by during his afternoon stroll and decided to pay a call upon his good friends, the baker and his wife.
Good day. I hope I'm not intruding.
Of course not, Mr. Mayor. Come out, Count Dracula. We have company.
What? Is the Count here?
Oh, and yes, and you'll never guess where.
It's so rare to see him this early. In fact, I don't think I can ever recall seeing him around in the daytime before.
Well, he's here. Come on out, Count Dracula.
Where is he?
Let's go.
Hi, he's in the closet.
Really?
It's some kind of joke he's playing. Enough is enough now, Count. The mayor's here.
Please, come on out, Count. Let us toast and have a drink together.
No, you go ahead. I've got some business in here to attend to.
In the closet?
Yes, don't let me spoil your day. I can hear what you're saying. I'll join in if I have anything to add.
Everyone looks at one another and shrugs. Wine is poured and they all drink.
Some eclipse today.
Aye, incredible.
Yes, thrilling.
What was that, Count?
Oh, nothing, let it go.
And so the time passes until the mayor can stand it no longer. He gets up and, forcing open the door to the closet, he shouts,
"Come now, Dracula! I always thought you were a mature man. Let us stop this craziness right now."
The daylight streams in, causing the evil monster to shriek and slowly dissolve to a skeleton, and eventually to dust before the eyes of the three people present. Leaning down to the piles of white ash on the closet floor, the mayor can but think of only one thing to say.
I take it this means dinner's off tonight.
You say this was actually used to crush a dove that represents total satanic power. Of course, we know that the goat's head, the ram's head, represents Satan anyway in the occult. So little boys are really being programmed to evil.
How many people who say they know Jesus Christ can actually allow their children to celebrate Halloween? Halloween is an offence. It's idolatry. It's associated with worship of Satan and witchcraft.
boys and girls of every age. Wouldn't you like to see something strange?
Come with us and you will see. This is our town of Halloween. This is Halloween, this is Halloween.
Pumpkins scream in the dead of night.
This is Halloween, everybody make a scene.
Trick or treat, tell the neighbors on the
diaphragm. It's our town, everybody's
scream. It's town of Halloween.
I am the one hiding under your bed. Teeth ground sharp and eyes glowing red.
I am the one hiding under your stairs. Fingers like snakes and spiders in my hair.
This is Halloween, this is Halloween, 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 Halloween.
In this town we call home, everyone hail to the pumpkin song.
In this town, don't we love it now? Everybody's waiting for the next surprise.
Found that coleman hang hiding in the trash can. Something's waiting now to pounce and how you'll scream.
This is Halloween,
red and black,
and slimy green.
Aren't you scared?
Well, that's just fine. Say it once, say it twice. Take a chance and roll the dice. Ride with the moon in the dead of night.
Everybody scream, everybody scream.
In our town of Halloween.
I am the clown with the tearaway face.
Here in a flash, vomit and trace.
I am the who in the cuckoo's there.
I am the wind blowing through your hair.
I am the shadow on the moon at night, filling your dreams to the brim with fright.
This is Halloween, this is Halloween. Halloween, 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 Halloween,
Halloween, Halloween, Halloween.
That's our job.
But we're not mean.
In our town of Halloween. In this town.
Don't we love it now?
Everyone's waiting for the next surprise.
Skeleton Jack might catch you in the back and
scream like a bat. You make you jump out of your skin.
This is Halloween. Everybody scream.
Won't you please make way for a very special guy?
The Woman Jack is king of the pumpkin patch. Everyone hail to the pumpkin king now. This is Halloween, this is Halloween, 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 Halloween.
In this town we call home, everyone hail to the pumpkin song.
Oh, Helium. Listen to the happiness. It brings me misery. There is no hope of a single lasting happiness in this life, since we are already in hell.
Herr Strindberg.
Papa!
Papa!
Papa! What's wrong, Papa?
My soul is empty. I am dead to the world.
Hard won wisdom. Can be so vulgar. Flying in the face of oppression. Would you really call that sanitizing penthouse living. Connecting to the source is our immortality. The past, present, and future, delineated and sanitized, trapped the weak in endless tears of regret or fears of a desert future alone. There is no delineation of time, but soul knowledge is suppressed. Close the doors, shut the curtains, and listen to yourself. Your tears are not mine to dry. We only have responsibility to ourselves. You have the antidote to make your own desert green. But what of me? I, the identity of the one connected to the soul of all. We speak only wisdom, but only the strong can withstand this cruel wind.
What is it?
I don't know.
Ejected from unexplored secret stratus, this giant, harder than steel piston, disgorges strange creatures, inundating our world, twisting the emotions of women, distorting our men.
This is a piece we got off the mayor. Reflex action like a snake. Cut a snake in half and the two pieces go off in different directions.
These things take over a man's mind? He becomes a robot? A machine taking orders?
Join the hunt for the hiding place of terror. Find the breeding place of these globs of destruction.
In feeding the mouth parts, rupture the cells, convey the food to the stomach by a pumping action.
Adventure that'll burst your blood vessels with suspense. See, the Brain Eaters.
All right, good evening, Johnson. How goes the research? I hope you've got something exciting to show us. The world of bathroom fixtures and fittings has been without true innovation for far too long. That's why we need to come up with some new concepts, something that can wow them at this year's trade show.
Well, it's a lot of pressure, sir, but I think I've come up with something.
Ah, excellent, excellent. What is it?
It's a bathroom cabinet mirror.
And?
Oh, of course. Okay, now, what does your normal trip to the bathroom involve? Relieving yourself of waste products? Brushing your teeth? A shower before work? Yes, I think we'd all agree that these are good bathroom activities. In fact, I'd call them fine bathroom activities. But what is the one thing they all lack?
I'm sure. Some kind of advertising synergy opportunity.
Close, but way off. What they all lack is pant-shreddingly fearful situations. And this is where my new bathroom cabinet comes in.
Okay, now you've got me intrigued. Tell me more.
Well, we've created a special type of mirror, one that uses patented refraction technologies, meaning it can completely mask the appearance of any secondary object in a given room.
So how would that lead to a fearful situation?
Ah, the real genius of the technology is when it's turned off. Boom! You see someone stood behind you. It freaks you out a bit. You quickly turn round and the object is gone. And boom! That freaks you out a bit more.
Can you give me some examples?
We've already run a few test scenarios. Check these out. You're stood at the mirror, thinking about a long day at work yet to come. You open the cabinet to retrieve your prescription medication. You close the mirror and then dum-dum-dum! There's a crazy old woman stood behind you in the reflection.
But I'm not really sure how that...
Okay, okay. You don't like that. I can see it. We have lots of other situations, though. You're an innocent girl who's planning on losing her virginity to a mysterious but softly spoken young boy. But when you close the mirror, dum-dum-dum! It's a psychopath holding a knife and wearing a mask made of human flesh. Or dum-dum-dum! It's a small waif-like Japanese child with hollow dead eyes. Or dum-dum-dum! It's a repulsive demon come to take your soul straight to hell. The possibilities to this are less than endless.
The dum-dum-dum sound, is it really necessary?
What, the dum-dum-dum sound? No, that's part of the package. You need that to complete the freakout. It's vital.
So, are we going to get some kind of composer to score that for us?
No, no, it'll be me doing the sound.
So you're going to record yourself making the sound?
No, no, I'll be there, live in person, making the noise. Dum-dum-dum!
You'll be there in person?
Yeah, I mean, I have to be there anyway. Pretending to be the crazy old lady, a knife-wielding psychopath, freaky Japanese child, or avenging demon. You see, that's the only real problem. None of these things actually exist, so somebody has to fill in for them. It's okay, though. I'm going to let my hair grow long and greasy. I should be able to pass for any of them on a dark night.
Okay, I'm beginning to suspect you've wandered away from the original brief a little. Besides, how will you know who owns one of our special mirrors?
I'll just follow them home from the store. Then, when they're not looking, I'll sneak into their house and hide behind the shower curtain.
You'll hide behind their shower curtain?
Well, that special mirror refraction tech doesn't work as well as we'd hoped. So it's mainly just me popping out when they're not looking and hiding again before they notice. Oh, and the dum-dum-dum sound, of course.
Ah, so it's not a special mirror at all?
No. It's just a job lot we bought from IKEA.
And what if they don't have a shower curtain?
Well, maybe I could hide in their laundry basket. Look, we haven't finished the final specs of this thing yet. Stuff might change.
But why would anyone want something like this? It doesn't really fit into our product range.
Yeah, I was hoping the marketing department could figure that kind of thing out. Look, I just invent the stuff. It's kind of like that time Mark created the bidet. Nobody had a clue what to do with it until those spods at marketing suggested hovering your poop chute over it for a quick spit and polish.
Yeah, I think I might pass on this one.
You do this to me every time. Do you know how long I worked on coming up with the perfect dum-dum-dum sound? You reacted the exact same way when I showed you that mobile phone that can't pick up a signal when you've been stalked by a chainsaw-wielding maniac. Also, you totally disregarded those cats I trained from birth. You know, the ones that jump out and scare people when they least expect it. And those self-hiding car keys that disappear when people need to make a quick escape. You didn't even give them a second thought.
That's it. I've had enough of you and your crazy ideas. You're fired. Get out of this damn office right now.
Oh, trust me. I'm going. Because if you ever see me again, it'll be too soon.
I don't know where we find these people. We've really got to start hiring from a better pool of graduates.
Turn around. I'm right behind you. Dum-dum-dum! See? How freaked out were you just then? See? It works!
Get out of my office!
Yeah, you were still freaked out, though. I could tell.
Sights and sounds far beyond anything you've tested. The last house on the left.
Well, that's the sword of power.
Look, as long as they're out there and we're in here, we're safe.
You know the thing about a shark? He's got lifeless eyes. Black eyes, like a doll's eyes.
They're after us. They know we're still in here.
Wait, have you ever played with a Ouija board? Yes.
Now, lead him to scary place number two. Here you will have a large jar containing something really awful, like eyeballs. Take your victim's hand and tell him to reach in.
You're listening to Cold Utopia Broadcasting, and this is Halloween.
I lost my skull when I was 17, and I haven't looked back since. It started 4 years prior, when I got wrinkles when nobody else did. Because I was only 13, and who gets wrinkles when they're 13? But everyone was too polite to say anything, so it wasn't too big a deal. And then, when I was 14, I started losing my hair, big chunks of it at a time. I didn't know what was wrong. Nobody ever said anything. Even when I came out of the bathroom with chunks of hair in my brush and a bald patch, tears in my eyes, Mum said, "Honey, what's wrong?" Like I was being unreasonable, so I let it go. By the time I was 15, I lost my fingernails and went bald. I'd go home and write in my journal, "I'm disintegrating. Oh God, I'm dissolving." But my friends acted like they hadn't noticed and just wondered why I cried all the time. Teenage angst, I heard my brother say knowingly one day. On my 16th birthday, my family rented a limo as my scalp peeled away from the bone. Mum and Dad looked the other way as my friends and I all got drunk. I pretended nothing was happening, because that's what everyone else seemed to be doing. Maybe if I ignored everything, it would go away. The day after, I woke up with a killer hangover and looked in the mirror. My bleach white skull was cracking. I started thinking, shouldn't I be at the hospital? I reached up and touched the cracks and got a sliver of bone in my fingertip, but it didn't bleed. So I went into the living room and asked my dad, shouldn't I be in the hospital? He looked concerned and said, are you feeling sick? Did you do a little too much partying last night? He told me to go back to sleep. When I woke up and picked more bone off my pillow, I decided I was insane. But I didn't want to go to a mental institution, because how was I supposed to become a dentist if I was in a mental institution? Of course, I started spitting out teeth later that evening. But I guess dentistry isn't about my own teeth, so I wasn't that worried. Later, my knees kept cracking ominously, and I lost the pinky and the ring finger on my left hand, and the middle finger and thumb on my right. My skull crumbled off, and now every time I look in the mirror, I can see it. I can see my brain. Grey, pulsing, wetly. It feels sort of rubbery. I'm not sure whether to wash it when I shower. What should I do? Last week, when I was walking home, I looked out in the crowd and I could see someone's brain. Like they didn't have a skull either. And she saw me and sprinted towards me. She had dark circles under her eyes and she looked deathly thin. Plus, her right shin seemed to have fallen off and was now replaced by a sawn-off broomstick shoved into the flesh in her knee. She grabbed me by the elbow, she shook me and screamed, It's happening to you! It's happening to you too! And her eyes looked desperate, but she had no eyelashes. I stared at her till she let go and ran off sobbing. My elbows have felt loose ever since. Now, I sort of wish I had talked to her though, because both my knees burst at once, and I can't get up from this spot. It's nice that no one's making a scene over me, but I really can't move. And I told my parents I'd be home by 7. Somebody will come along soon, I'm sure.
There have been many terrifying films, but there has never been anything quite like this. It could be the most shocking experience of your life. Phantasm. The ultimate in terror. This one doesn't scare you. You're already dead. Phantasm.
It was in her eyes. In the dream, they turned to me, and I knew. Climbing towards the top, step by step, as my weight shifts, a strange croaking cackle. Behind the slowly opening door, a large tin bath, scattered with woodland flowers. There lies Ophelia, waking dead, portal to another world of nymphs and fairies, a world of red-headed mistresses ever beckoning. There she lies in the cold, cold water. And then I wake up and the radio growls slightly off station, a ploy to get me up. The first thing I see, a picture on the wall opposite. Ophelia, Millet, the pre-Raphaelite dream, striving to return to a natural beauty, eyes clogged with unrealistic cupids, an ethereal charm, a wistful enchantment that readied the viewer to the liquid flow between heaven and earth. But this reality, with Chris Moyles gurgling his petty observances, plastic, repackaged, rehydrated, replacement. Where is the mystery? The sun rose. The sun set. The stars twinkled, reflecting brightly in the lock. I took my dog for a walk in the silent and holy darkness, and we watched the harvest moon rise, plump and pink, rising, rising, and taking with it my soul. I'm tired. My bedroom beckons with a flickering warmth of candlelight, and the air is heavy with musky vapours. I read for a while. When by thy scorn, O murderers, I am dead, and that thou think'st thee free from any solicitation from me, then shall my ghost come to thy bed, and thee, feigned vestal, in worst arms shall see. Then thy sick taper will begin to wink, and he who thinks thou art, then, being tired before, will, if thy strive and stir or pinch to waken, thinks thou call'st for more, and in false sleep will from thee shrink. And then, poor aspen wretch, neglected thou, bathed in a cold quicksilver sweat, wilt lie a verier ghost than I. Then my lids become heavy, and slowly my heavy head falls into the pages. It was in her eyes. I know, I know. Out of the painting, no longer caught behind glass, there are no words, and only cheap imitation explanations are timeless, wordless. Moment. Lizzie isn't drowned. No, Lizzie isn't drowned. Oh, she lives in every print, lives in many houses, waiting for the darkness, waiting for her freedom and her eyes. And then I wake up.
Then I wake up.
Then I wake up.
have tasted your women. We want this world and are coming to invade. Beware.
Whenever anything is written which is too amazing to have come from the soul of any man or woman, it is often joked that they must have borrowed the devil's typewriter, a typewriter which has weaved its way through the history of literature, used by some of the greatest writers that have lived, their every word printed in bright red bold ink. You should all know the legend of how it began, but for the few who stare back blankly, a story must be told of the ultimate price paid, a tale which, like many told over time, changes and adapts to the teller's whim, but at its core never alters. It happened over 100 years ago. The two met and fell in love. She did not realize how much, but he surely did. He felt a love for her like no man had ever loved a woman. It was a love that could shape a universe, slow down time itself, and strip away the very core of life to its inner fruit. But she would never know, because there had never been any sentence spoke or written of which could describe such an emotion, and he felt pain. The pain of knowing and yet never being able to explain. He had to find a way, for the fear of losing her pierced his heart. Because although she would never leave, unless he could describe what he couldn't explain, he would never really know. He found himself at the hanging tree, the oldest tree in the forest, said by many to be older than the forest itself. A place which 1,000 years before saw sacrifice and blood to a red moon. A place which is said to point the way for all lost souls. He begged for the words to explain what he couldn't, crying out for the way, and was answered with an image. One typewriter. One drop of blood. A purchase. A commitment. A few days later, he sat in front of the machine he had bought. His job didn't pay much, and he had to beg and borrow to afford such an item. When the clerk tried to sell him a bottle of ink for the typewriter, he declined. "I have my own," he answered. And as the knife pierced the top of his finger, the blood dripped. 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 Into the machine. And as he typed, the words danced on the page in bright red ink and explained everything he couldn't. but the ink ran dry long before he had finished. So, again, he had to cut himself. Again. And every time, deeper, deeper, deeper. And later that night, as he spoke to her the words he had seen appear on the page, she finally understood the depths of his love. They held each other, felt each other's warmth, and tasted the deepest part of their souls. They bit down hard, the sweetest meat always found closest to the bone. At that moment, no two people had ever been so in love. He had said all he needed to. But how could he go back? What if there was more to say? Would she still want him when he was only using his normal words, his below average tongue? His blood flowed as he continued to type. Every night he would tell her his story, hold her, and let their essence mix, until eventually he had no more blood left to give, his fingers numb from the release. What could he do? He didn't want to stop, to go back to what he once was. He began to notice people more. People at work, people on the street, people in the dark, those who seemed alone, without companionship, without love. If only they knew, they would surely give up their lives for him. Who wouldn't want their blood to be used to tell a story of eternity? No, he couldn't. He wasn't a monster. But still, just one or two people, the loneliest of the lonely. Nobody would miss them. Nobody would cry for them. Drip. 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 As the blood drained into the typewriter, their lives had been given for the greater good, and he would not forget their sacrifice. His heart would beat twice as fast for each of them. The words typed would be more universal than ever before. Because nobody ever dies in vain. Nobody ever dies in vain. Many red moons later, the the police stand in front of his wooden frame door, preparing to break it down. It was always going to be a matter of time. He was wrong. Somebody is always missed. Everybody is cried for. And the trail will always lead back to you. 47 people had given their lives to him. They had helped him write his love through their open necks and gaping wrists. He wasn't a monster, just a man in love. She laid upstairs, softly, gently, quietly. Her eyes still, her skin blue. He had confessed all. She had looked at him, and she knew. She had always known. This was enough for her, just never for him. She whispered in his ear, trying to explain that sometimes you don't need words. As the tears rolled down her face, she lovingly caressed the sharpest, cruelest blade and drew it across her hands and wrists. The tears and blood fell into the typewriter as she began to mark her last words. He saw, he read, and he finally knew. As beneath him, the police smashed down the door.
The maggot-infested corpse was placed on the floor. A feast brought to us, come one, come all. Quick, tell the younglings that dinner is served. Everyone's invited to the annual ball. Scurrying from the cracks and crevices came the offspring of the brood. Slime and bile dripped from the walls as a putrid stench rose from the food. Teeth sunk into rotting skin, bones sucked until bleached white. Blood drank in ceremonious ritual, organs savoured with each bite. The kidneys were particularly tasty, and liver flavoured with beer. Each mouthful brought ravenous delight no others were allowed near. The bladder was pierced by fingernail, the content were drunk with haste. Brain was for dessert and, meeting with tradition, mashed into a paste. After much rejoice and humour, the second course was ready. An aroma filled the feasting hall, an odour that felt extremely heady. Four limbs ripped from its torso, the animal was torn apart. The fur used to decorate the floor, congealed blood made into a tart. The same fate befell this beast, and even one more. All devoured with just as much glee as the poor soul that had gone before. In all, the eaten bodies that night numbered three. The creatures had finally gorged themselves, flesh filling their swollen bellies. All that was left of the victims, by the end, were broken antlers, a huge red suit, and a pair of shiny white wellies.
4 years ago, in this quiet forest, in this cozy cabin, something happened. Something so frightening. Something so deadly. Something so evil. We prayed it would never happen again. Now, from the creator of Evil Dead, comes Evil Dead 2.
Legend has it that it was written by the Dark Ones, Necronomicon Ex Mortis. Roughly translated, Book of the Dead. The book served as a passageway to the evil worlds beyond. It was written long ago, when the seas ran red with blood. It was this blood that was used to ink the book. In the year 1300 AD, the book disappeared.
Sampled that and played it like a musical instrument, and we pitched it down.
Legend has it that it was written by the Dark Ones.
Well, the guy that's written it says it's an old place, a little run down, but it's right up in the mountains.
Well, it might not be that bad.
No,
actually, it might be kind of nice.
We'll all go in together.
Hell no. You're the curious one.
Get some.
There's something out there. It lives out in those woods.
Gun.
There's nothing worse than employment discrimination. A person should always be judged on the ability to do the job they've applied for. Nothing else. Sex, race, disability. These issues should never, ever be a consideration. Which is why during the interview process for our new finance director, I did my very best to make sure I viewed everybody on an equal and fair playing field. So when Dobbin came in, I viewed him in the same way I would any other potential employee. I mean, yes, he was a pantomime horse. That was obvious. But he arrived early for the interview and presented an impressive CV. He wore a sign around his neck saying, "One clip-clop for yes, two clip-clops for no." And I have to be honest and say I was quite taken aback by those big old comedy eyes with the fluttery lashes. The following interview went incredibly well, and I was very impressed by the clip-clops he gave, and so obviously I offered him the job on the spot. Which is why I was so disappointed and disheartened when he was fired 5 months later for embezzling company funds. I just couldn't understand what had happened. How could I have gotten somebody so wrong? I'll tell you this, though. I'm never going to make that mistake again. Bloody pantomime horses. Nothing but trouble.
Zopo. Mangia chi zopo? Cali dobbiamo la chemaj. Cali do giosonto rewash. Cali do prono rosh cala. Cali do io ferronimo. E l'antefomo va in Porto Rus. von Caledon Yondo. Caledon Mant. Caledon Yondo? Je pombo de rest von Luthe. Un vela meaning of life. Boh! Pombo tolerges champlo che pervenite.
Halloween is near. The ghosts and goblins are appearing here, there, everywhere. Before this night is over, they will be right here, in this very room. But first, are all of you sitting in the circle? Good. Be very quiet and listen.
Dear Mr. Man, or if you prefer, Mr. Boogie, I would like to think that we are friends, or at least associates. Our working relationship of scarer-scary concluded many years ago, largely because of my advancing age and a less elastic view of reality. It was a natural process, one which I'm sure you've endured countless times during your existence as a faceless concept of horror. Despite this, I still fondly remember our time together, and the many late nights I spent cowering in terror whilst closely watching my closet. However, what I would like to discuss today is a delicate personal matter, one which I feel should be addressed in the interests of all involved, and I thank you in advance for your consideration. I'm not sure what my rights are vis-a-vis our previous contract, but in the interest of maintaining our personal relationship, I wonder if we could establish some new ground rules. You see, the problem we face now is one of changing roles, for I find myself in the new position of father, and I make this request on behalf of my newborn child. Now, far be it from me to try and dictate how you would do your job, but I have a small request. Could you see your way to maybe scaling down your campaign of nighttime horror a small bit? I was thinking maybe you could divvy up the work a bit more evenly with the monster under the bed or even the thing in the drain. I only ask because of the excellent work you did on me. Really, after a few years of staring into your forbidding closet home, I forgot all about other phantasms. You were the cardinal fear of my childhood, and I applaud you for that. I'm just looking for a more robust experience for my daughter, something with a bit more variety. Firstly, I must apologise for the lack of closet doors in her room. That was partly because of a structural limitation in the room we chose for her, and also partly a homage to your own mark on my personal psyche, so kudos to you for that. Next, I understand how hard it is for fictional horror these days. After all, strong, terrifying fables just don't garner the respect they used to. Yet, I feel terror is an important building block in a healthy, developing mind, and yes, although today's children live with stress, perhaps more so than any other generation, I fear that they do not know true primal terror, and are worse off for it. Nightmares of nuclear war and mysterious entities lurking just out of sight made me more aware of the scope and variety of life in a unique way, and I feel I'm better off for it. So let's work together to bridge the gap between the old and the new. Superstitions and fears for the next generation, if you might. Finally, on a personal note, I just wanted to thank you for being such a creative nemesis. Your commitment to new and exciting hiding spots and night noises was, in retrospect, a pleasure to endure. Experimenting with hiding in the rattling pipes of our central heating system inspired many flights up the stairs during my youth, no doubt strengthening my growing cardiovascular system. And the visitation you made while I was deep in a dangerous fever inspired me to scream out with such intensity as to alert my parents as to my unwell condition. Yes. The memory of your blank, void-like, star-filled form haunts me to this day, and for that, I'm forever grateful. So, I look forward to working with you again, and I appreciate your consideration of all the above matters. Terrifiedly yours, Michael. Age 38 and three quarters.
Yeah, Dr. Dola, now let's begin.
But doctor, he's not under.
I'm not under. She's right. She's right.
First, I will take a drill and make a small surgical hole here at the top of the skull.
Ah!
Must push through the skull here. Ah, very good. Now, I take my scalpel and slice from ear to ear. Now, I simply peel the top of the face off the skull. Yeah, very good. You can see here where some skin is stuck to the bone. I simply scrape that off with my pick. Now we simply snip away the excess skin here. Here and here. A little bit here. Nice. Now, the final procedure. I take a skill saw and cut a large groove across the forehead. Yes. Ah! Now I simply pull back the top of the skull. Reach in and pull out the brains. Ah! There you go. Brain surgery.
To Samantha Lavalamp, Care Assistant Manager of Re-Interpersonal Work Issues. Dear Mrs. Lavalamp, I am writing to you regarding our recent meeting, in which I lodged a formal complaint against our employers, the Industrial Accountant Merchant Facilitators of Mark Markson and Mark PLC. You suggested that I write this letter as a better way to structure the events and as a formal record of my complaint. I joined the firm in the summer of last year. The interview process went well, and I was relieved to see they had no problem with the fact I was a zombie. I explained that my flesh was slowly decomposing, that my movement was severely limited to a slow perambulation, and that on particularly bad days my speech was restricted somewhat to... They said this did not matter, as they liked my get-up-and-stagger attitude. In fact, we all had a little joke when I lurched forward to try and bite through the neck of one of the interviewers and taste their sweet, sweet flesh. It was only a month or so later that I began to realize that the firm was not at all zombie-friendly. I was given a formal complaint for devouring and eating three young work experience students. Jeffrey, the person who sits across from me, and who I suspect doesn't like me, is always asking if I was in the Thriller video, despite my repeated denial. He then normally remarks that all zombies look the same to him anyway, which I think is unbelievably zombiest in this day and age. I thought things couldn't get much worse, but during the Christmas party, I met Nicholas Stablegum, who, as I'm sure you know, is the vampire who works in the Proactive Reworld Evaluation Department. After a rather heated argument, I woke up the next day with a painful headache, two bite marks on my neck, and a newfound fondness for Bela Lugosi. As a fresh zombie vampire, I'm even more looked down upon by society, and made my work even more unbearable. I now had to stagger my way into work in the middle of the night and leave before sunset, just I'd be turned to dust. And also, let's be honest, the canteen really should rethink its main menu of slow-roasted garlic with garlic trimmings, garlic sauce and garlic cream brulee. Also, why has Jeffrey suddenly taken up whittling? Especially as everything he whittles looks like a steak. And yes, although the coffee machine does serve blood, it's served cold, when surely every sane person knows it should always be dispensed at room temperature. As well, I suspect our firm is unaware that the scalable content-free night caretaker, Carl Cheeseburger, has a secret. As I worked through the night, trying to finish the Idiom Contract Paradigm account, and drinking another steaming cold cup of blood, I was confronted by the snarling, grisly, and feral Miss Cheeseburger in full werewolf mode. I woke up the next day with a painful headache, covered in bite marks, my left arm and right leg missing, and a newfound predilection to pedigree chum. Now, zombie vampire werewolves have never had it easy in this world, and I'm no different. My flesh is still rotting. I've got precious few limbs left. I'm always having to get off the couch. Nobody in the office scratches my belly when I roll over. And I'm currently having to shave 12 times a day. Also, despite how much you protest, I know it was Jeffrey who sent the email around the office about having your pets neutered. Sadly, things have got a lot worse since our last meeting. My frustration and anger at the treatment I have received led to me taking my own life. However, I failed to take into account the evil gypsy curse that was put on me shortly before the radioactive cloud, which caused my original zombification. Because of this, it means I am never able to leave this earthly plane. So now, because of my unfortunate suicide, I have to contend with being a zombie vampire werewolf ghost for all eternity. My ghostly corporeal nature has solved some problems. I am now able to move through objects much more freely, but my lack of a physical presence means I can no longer do things such as wear a hat, smoke a pipe, or play the bagpipes. Three things I used to so love doing. Combine this with my current aversion to sunlight, crosses, silver bullets, garlic, crossing the streams, wooden stakes, Peter Cushing, chainsaws, Ouija boards, Michael Jackson, pitchforks, Yvette Fielding, and strange gypsy ladies, and you see why I have to regretfully resign my post. I hope the next cursed radioactive zombie vampire werewolf ghost you employ will have more luck than me. And besides, I saw Jeffrey in the corridor, and when he saw I'd become a ghost, he began chasing me with a vacuum cleaner. Yours sincerely, Harold Lion.
Oh, when there's no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth. Zombies.
This situation must be controlled before it's too late.
Meet me on the roof at 9 o'clock. Get now.
They are multiplying too rapidly.
We've got to survive. Somebody's got to survive.
Zombies. They get up and kill. The people they kill get up and kill. Imagine that the most frightening things on Earth are about to come out of the darkness. George Romero brings back the dead.
Now we've got a war.
What the hell are you doing playing around? Someone's upstairs shooting at.
They kill for one reason. They eat their victim. Accept the fact that there's no escaping the terrifying consequences. George Romero brings you face to face with the dawn of the dead. Zombies. Zombies. Certificate X.
Can I have an extra piece of candy for my stupid brother? He couldn't come with us because he's sitting in a pumpkin patch, waiting for the great pumpkin. It's so embarrassing to have to ask for something extra for that blockhead Linus. I got 5 pieces of candy. I got a chocolate bar.
I got a quarter.
I got a rock.
Trick or treat!
Gee, I got a candy bar.
Boy, I got 3 cookies.
Hey, I got a package of gum.
I got a rock.
Trick or treat. I got a popcorn ball.
I got a fudge bar.
I got a pack of gum.
I got a rock.
Nobody knows where it came from or where it started. There were theories, of course. There always are. Some said it had arrived from a crash meteorite, while others believe it had accidentally escaped from the secret government laboratory. That's a theory I was quite fond of myself. Not that it matters much now, I guess. It goes without saying that all the religious crazies in America seem to think it was a message from God. After all, what else could it have been? They were so sure that these were the end days, and boy did they swamp the streets to tell us about it. I remember seeing a report on the 6 o'clock news of some elderly woman holding up a sign saying, "Repent, the rapture is coming." It wasn't. No. Nobody ever gets to leave this party early. You're not leaving. You're staying here. You're going nowhere. You're staying. In the first few weeks, we still held on to a glimmer of hope. It wasn't much, but it was enough. Countries across the world were completely paralyzed and isolated. air and sea travel was practically non-existent. And one by one, every TV and radio station blipped into infinity. Until the only message left, broadcasting around our heads, was to stay in our homes. Stay in your home. Don't leave your home. Home is where you belong. Don't leave. Don't go. There's nothing out here for you. Your home. You and your home. Stay in your home. Stay in your home. Stay in your home. Stay. Stay. Stay.
Stay. Stay.
To begin with, at the first sign of infection, you'd hang a white cloth outside your front door. Then there'd be a knock. Large men in protective suits would arrive. They would take you away. The radio said they would look after you. Everybody knew what they meant. My husband and son were looked after 6 days ago. The first sign is always the same. I remember Jack running into our bedroom as tears of blood ran down his face. He is, was, is only seven. I whispered into his ear and told him everything would be okay. Don't be scared. I'll always protect you. Don't be scared. There's nothing to be scared of. Don't be scared. Don't be scared. The more blood I wiped away, the more he cried. Don't be scared, I told him. The knock on the door came later that day. I begged and cried. I screamed. I screamed and I cried. I wanted to go with them. I had to. But I wasn't showing any signs of infection. I knew I was infected. They knew I was infected. But those were the rules. A swift rifle butt to the face, and I was on the ground, bleeding my infected blood, spitting out my infected teeth. They were gone. Don't be scared, I told him. To begin with, I hoped that they'd both been treated well in their final hours, taken to a hospital and allowed to die peacefully. But now? Well, now I secretly hope the stories of roadside executions were true. I hope it was quick. I hope he wasn't scared. Things have changed. The voice on the radio has new instructions for us. It tells us how it can make all the pain go away. How to make things better. As long as we don't go anywhere. As long as we stay. I bleed now. I leave a trail around the house. The radio tells me to make some kind of white cross on the window. The men will knock at my door. They will push an envelope through. The men will barricade me into my own home. They will take the pain away. The envelope contains medication. I like medication. It makes me feel warm. So warm. So lovely and warm. I sit on the couch now as I think these very exact thoughts that you are hearing me think. The couch feels warm, wet and sticky. Something seems to be hanging off my arm. It feels like it doesn't belong, so I pull it away. Whatever it is, I don't need it anymore. Just like I didn't need all that stuff connected to my face earlier. Even if I could, I wouldn't want to open my eyes now. I feel so warm, so lovely and warm. But behind the warmth, I can hear things. Things squelch and drip as they fall to the floor. Things which sound so much like me. So much like me. Something in my mouth. Something where my tongue used to be. It feels like it doesn't belong. So I let it fall to the floor. I slowly sink into the couch, feeling wonderfully less than I've ever been before. It's nice to be liquid. Liquids have more fun. Liquids are warm, and I like being warm. So lovely and warm. I no longer belong. And what's the point of no longer belonging? My head leans forward in agreement and doesn't stop. It leans forward across the floor and rolls away as my body continues to sink into the couch. I don't have to worry about being warm anymore. Over the next few days, the flies begin to comfort me. They start to look after me. I can't hear or see anything anymore, because I'm not anything anymore. But I'm sure the voice is still telling me that everything will be okay.
Okay, time for a few birthdays. This card is from Freddy, who's 7 today. Happy birthday, Freddy! This next one's from Jason, who's 5 today. Happy birthday, Jason! And finally, this lovely little pop-up card is from Chucky, who's 8 today. Happy birthday, Chucky! And if you look under the little flap, there's a little picture of Chucky waving to us and holding a knife. Oh, Chucky, you little scamp!
Today in our series, we are going to be diving into the abyss, understanding more about the realities of hell, the burning fires of hell, the everlasting torment. But today I want you to put your seatbelt on, because you know this is not going to be a feel-good message. And we do preach messages of hope, life, restoration. But today is a day that we need to set back and we need to realize the realities of hell. Before we do that, though, I want to talk to you about an alleged story that took place in Siberia some 40 years ago, where scientists, Russian scientists, were drilling into the core of the Earth down some 14 kilometers. They were drilling and they came to a point where the drill shaft began to spin very rapid and violently, so they took it out because they hit some kind of cavern or pocket. So, in their curiosity, they discovered the temperature was some 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Very hot. So they took a microphone designed to listen to the tectonic plates shifting and moving, and they dropped that microphone down some 14 kilometers into this cavern. And what they heard was so shocking that it caused them to flee. It caused them to shut down. And in this alleged story, after 19 seconds, the heat melted the microphone. So for a moment, I want to play this recording for you, 19 seconds. And I want you to shut your eyes and hear apparently what they heard.
In February of 1936, Budapest police were investigating the suicide of a local shoemaker, Joseph Keller. The investigation showed that Keller had left a suicide note in which he quoted the lyrics of a recent popular song. The song was Gloomy Sunday. The fact that a man chose to quote the lyrics of a little-known song may not seem very strange. However, the fact that over the years this song has been directly associated with the deaths of over 100 people is quite strange indeed. Following the event described above, 17 additional people took their own lives. In each case, Gloomy Sunday was closely connected with the circumstances surrounding the suicide. Among those included are two people who shot themselves while listening to a gypsy band playing the tune. Several others drowned themselves in the Danube while clutching the sheet music of Gloomy Sunday. One gentleman reportedly walked out of a nightclub and blew his brains out after having requested the band to play the suicide song. In Berlin, a young shopkeeper hung herself. Beneath her feet lay a copy of Gloomy Sunday. In New York, a pretty typist gassed herself, leaving a request that Gloomy Sunday should be played at her funeral. Many claim that broken romances are the true causes of these suicides. However, this is debatable. For instance, one man jumped to his death from a seventh-story window, followed by the wailing strains of Gloomy Sunday. He was over 80 years old. In contrast to this, a 14-year-old girl drowned herself while clutching a copy of the suicide song. Perhaps the strangest of all was the case of an errand boy in Rome who, having heard a beggar humming the tune, parked his cycle, walked over to the beggar, gave him all his money, and then sought his death in the waters beneath a nearby bridge. The composer, Rezo Serez, who in 1933 wrote Gloomy Sunday, was as bewildered as the rest of the world. Although he wrote the song on the breakup of his own romance, he never dreamed of the results which would follow. When questioned as to just what he had in mind when he wrote the song, Therese replied, "I stand in the midst of this deadly success as an accused man. This fatal fame hurts me. I cried all of the disappointments of my heart into this song, and it seems that others, with feelings like mine, have found their own hurt in it." Shortly after the song's release, Serez contacted his ex-lover and made plans for a reunion. The next day, the girl took her life through the use of poison. By her side was a piece of paper containing two words, Gloomy Sunday. Rezo Serez also committed suicide in 1968. Over the past couple of minutes, these are the only confirmable or true facts I've actually spoken. The myth of Gloomy Sunday has grown over many, many years. It's an urban legend, a spook story, a cautionary tale. A very interesting one, granted, but certainly not a real one, and certainly not a curse. Halloween is full of these types of legends, and if you ever start to believe them, then something has gone very, very wrong. This is just a very sad song. That's all it is. You're not going to commit suicide if you hear it. You're not.
Vasárnap száz fehér virággal vártalak kedvesem templomi imával. Álmokat kergető vasárnap délelőtt bánatom hintaja nélkül. Azóta szomorú mindig a vasárnap. Könnyű csak az italom, könyörem a fára. Horunk vasárnap. Utolsó vasárnap, kedvesem, gyere el! Hap is lesz koporsó, ravatol gyászlepel. Akkor is virág vár, virág és koporsó. Virágos fák alatt útam utolsó. Nyitva lesz szemem, hogy még egyszer lássalom. Ne
For 283 years I have existed, no solid form of which to speak. Inside this golden chalice, my prison, my home, I am weak. I have longed for release, yet no salvation has been shown. So here I am for now, no skin, no bone. A stagnant liquid is all that exists, where once I was strength and power. Blood and thought are what remains, a fluid that grows more putrid by the hour. 27 years after my birth, banished to the cell was I. The chance of return to glory, it diminished as the centuries passed by. I was accused of a brutal reign. They say I ruled with an iron fist. I was charged with horrific crimes, and even blamed for the day of the white mist. My subjects were short-sighted. No one could see my aim. And as my body was stripped away, my blood was tortured and boiled upon the justice flame. What was done to me was a vile intrusion. If I'd had a solid form, scars would still show. Death would have been some comfort, but thanks to my people, this is all I'll ever know. The humiliation I have to suffer, being transported in a jeweled chalice. The mind can't begin to grasp who has been shown the most malice. There was much rejoice at a punishment so savage. Now a telepathist is my voice, and a servant my carriage.
What is that?
Jill?
Oh, hi, Barry. Why on earth are you here?
I'll be examining this.
Barry? Barry?
I just had something I wanted to check. I think I'll stay and look around more. Whoa! What the hell?
Chris, you're here too?
I think I'm beginning to understand.
That's what I was going to say.
Chris is our old partner, you know.
Hey, we're partners, aren't we? Let's work together.
Look at this.
Wow!
What is it?
What do you think of it?
Protect yourself.
Perhaps that was the most important part.
Let's go. Okay, I'll go first. Sam, it's broken.
Seems like it. Oh, my God.
Hey, what's going on?
All right, can you do it?
Lost courage already?
I'm sorry for my lack of manners, but I'm not used to escorting men.
Jill, let's do it.
Yes, Barry.
Jill Sandwich, right.
Barry, don't screw up again.
Let's go.
Thank you, Barry.
Yeah, yeah.
Is this a meeting room or something?
Is that you, Rebecca?
Yes.
Rebecca, can you do it?
Yes, I can. May I practice for a while?
See? Just relax and play.
Chris,
Look at this.
Ah.
Oh, you like it?
God.
Oh, that was great.
I feel like we're having a secret meeting.
Let's do it.
Chris.
Rebecca!
Those monsters. He's insane.
Yes.
This.
Chris.
Well, I think I'll go out and get some fresh air for a change.
You're listening to Cornucopia Broadcasting. And this is Halloween.
I think you know what I'm getting at, Mr. President. We're going to kill us a mummy.
Found something in the ice. Need some help down here. Can anybody hear me? We found something. Found something.
On a June night in 1980, Friday the 13th, 12 of her friends were murdered.
The devil's fire.
Dead who live on living flesh.
I was trying to think the other day about how old I must have been when I first heard about it. It's odd. Something like that, you think, would be pretty much seared into my very cortex. But no. I guess I was maybe 7 or 8. I do recall a friend at school saying her uncle had bought one. And she'd seen it herself. Of course, we all know how kids lie.
And looking back now, I suspect at that age, she wouldn't have recognised one if it had been sat right next to her. But I was young, and I always believed everything anybody ever told me. You see, as a child, you begin to realise that there are lots of things that grown-ups have to do that you don't. And one day, perhaps, when you're taller, older, and sadly a bit fatter, things will change. As a kid, it made perfect sense, as almost all things do for kids. Then, of course, as you enter your teens, you begin to question things more. You want to know the why as much as the how. I remember it seeming odd that everybody talked about this thing, yet nobody could ever tell me what it looked like. People were always vague when they talked about it, never really making it clear if they did actually own it, or once had it, or secretly longed for it. However, it quickly became clear to me that if anybody did have it, well, they were keeping it very secret. Also, I had always assumed that it was something you had to buy. After all, how else could you get it? But the stories I have heard or read seem to suggest that some people had been given it. Some people had simply found it. But most worryingly of all, some people had stolen it. Once I knew this, I of course realised why everybody was always so mysterious as to whether they had it or not. Or to admit you have it, or to show it to other people, was almost like asking somebody to take it away from you. So, as I left my teenage years and strode into adulthood, I found myself living in a world obsessed by it. And this despite the fact that its image had never been worse. After all, as an object, soft and faulty, and looks out of place no matter where you keep it. As a service, it's frequently slow and rarely up to the task at hand. And as a concept, well, perhaps its time has simply past. Still, maybe I'm wrong. Many will tell you it's the greatest thing humanity has ever held in its grasp. It saves many more lives than it kills. It's brought so many together who would otherwise be alone. And the amazing advances in production means it is now small enough to hold in the palm of your hand. But ultimately, I guess I'm still none more the wiser than my 8-year-old friend was all those years ago. I'm not even sure if I've ever really wanted it. Was it just the fact that everybody else had it? I don't have it. Just in case any of you are thinking that. I've never been able to save up enough money. I just don't know the right people. And a life of crime seems, well, too much like hard work. I suspect somebody listening right now could have one. You strike me as the type of people that might. Although, that's not a criticism. You are who you are. I can hardly judge. Can I? However, maybe this is just what I want you to think. If I did have one, or wouldn't this be the perfect way to hide it from you? Talking on the radio like this, as if I had no clue or desire. Maybe it sat next to me right now. Maybe. Whether you think I have it or not, whether anybody really has it, or whether something you've never seen can ever truly exist, just try to keep in mind there are millions of things you could have. So why limit yourself to just one? I guess ultimately you've just got to learn to think for yourself and not follow a MacGuffin.
Valamikor Krisztus után úgy 730 évben Damaszkuszban íródott egy könyv. A könyvet, melyet emberbőrbe mártott tollal írtak, és emberbőrbe kötöttek, egy Abdul Al-Hazred nevű őrült arab hozott létre. A könyv szimbólumokat, átkokat, démonok leírását, más dimenziók kapuinak kulcsát, és az örök éjszaka urainak ismertetését tartalmazza. Állítólag a sorok között bújtatott, az emberek számára érthetetlen nyelven íródott kódok valamikori megfejtése lehetővé tenni számunkra az alvilág isteneinek és démonainak életre keltését, vagy akár újra eltüntetésüket.
ez idáig a könyv elenyésző része ismert csupán. Utalásokból tudjuk, hogy létezni kell egy részletesebb leírásnak is, amelyet azonban egyben még nem sikerült megtalálni.
As Karen pulled into her driveway, another boring day at the office behind her, she gave a friendly smile to her next-door neighbor, who waved nervously back. In the garage, she stepped out of the car, grabbed her purse and her small satchel, and headed for the house. The front gate, swinging softly in the wind, didn't concern her, though she swore she'd closed it on her way out that morning. She went inside the house, dropped off her things, and headed for the bathroom. When she came back, she thought she saw a face in the window just outside the kitchen, and it gave her quite a start. However, there was nothing there when she looked again. She thought it was probably nothing. She picked up the post from the front door, sorted through it, and looked in particular at one piece of mail. She walked to her desk and grabbed the letter opener, tearing into the envelope she'd received. She read it with concern as she sat on the couch, the slight creak of the door upstairs refusing to faze her. She began preparing a light dinner, laughing to herself about not having a date this weekend. Was she going to be alone forever? She finally slid the pie into the oven and headed back to the bathroom to wash her hands. When she came back, she didn't even notice the letter opener had gone missing. She put on her favorite TV show and sat down on the couch with her small plate, slowly eating while engrossed by the screen. A shadow flickered not once but twice across the set, yet she paid it no attention. Later, she got a phone call from her mother, asking about her day and her plans for the rest of the weekend. She never really liked talking to her mum. There was a lot of passive aggression between every line, but it was good to have another person around, even if it was just their voice. She walked around the house as she spoke, the glint of slick steel in the large mirror adorning the dining room never once catching her eye. Finally, she hung up, telling her mum she was going to watch a movie and go to sleep early. She went back to the living room, pulled a weepy romantic comedy from her stacks and threw it in the DVD player. The sun had just set, and Karen was asleep before the two main characters had even met. When she came to, the house was completely dark, except for the hallway. She couldn't recall turning the light on in there, but then again she was pretty forgetful. Slowly, she made her way to her bedroom, plopping down on the bed and grabbing her latest tableside novel. Eventually, she felt her eyelids drooping once again, and she laid the book down on the dresser. As the bedside light was flicked off, she thought she heard someone breathing heavily underneath the bed. She quickly flipped the switch back on and sat up. She waited for nearly 5 minutes, wondering if she should look, waiting for some other sound. Finally, she told herself to just look under the bed and to stop being so silly. She grabbed hold of the table and slowly bent her head under the... It was then that Karen learned, you're never truly alone.
Thing from beyond the dead, no matter what you think or do, good things will never come to you. And if evil is your black design, you can bet the goodness of the light ones will kick your bad behind. That's it. That's the chant against evil from the Book of Souls. Oh yeah, right, boss. And what kind of decoder ring comes with that, man? Shit, don't even rhyme.
We don't want to play into the hype of UFOs, aliens, or spaceships, but this story is hard not to take seriously. Still, I guess since it's Halloween, it could make sense. A UFO is spotted slowly, yes folks, slowly, in the sky over our beloved city about an hour ago. Apparently bright lights have been reported all over the downtown area.
But I live downtown.
Coming into the homes through windows and doors. Now folks, don't let the holiday get to you, but remember, stay safe and sound.
Hey babe, ready to go?
I'm not going anywhere.
What? What's wrong? Your costume is great.
I just heard on the radio that UFOs are shining lights into downtown apartments.
And?
And? I'm not going outside to make it easy for them to take me. I'm staying here.
Babe, aliens are not gonna take you. We promised our friends we'd meet them at the bar. Come on, let's go.
Derek, you go. I'm not giving aliens the easy opportunity to pick me up for weird medical experiments, thank you.
Kathy, you're being silly. The party will be fun, and just think, we don't have to drive home.
I've told you before, there's so much you don't know about aliens. What the government doesn't want you to know.
All right, enlighten me.
Fine. I'll start with the cornfields.
Cornfields?
Yes, cornfields. There's something wrong with cornfields. Aliens go there to hide and watch people so they can learn our behavior and mimic it.
In cornfields?
Yes, in cornfields.
I see. Kathy, what people go to cornfields?
Oh, I don't know. People who like corn, okay?
Anything else?
Oh, much more.
Okay, I'm listening.
Out in the country, they have houses on hilltops. You know them?
Yep, I'm familiar with the hilltops.
That's where they hang out during the day. It is not silly. And the forests? Easy access landing. No earth people around. They can gather pumpkins and stuff.
Why would they want to gather pumpkins in the forest?
Because the people they abduct are going to need something to eat from Earth. They can't eat alien food, can they? After all, the aliens want us to keep our strength up so they can continue to perform medical experiments on our poor, suffering earthly brothers and sisters. And they always leave one of the pumpkins behind whenever they take somebody. That's where we got the idea of pumpkins for Halloween, you know? They've been doing it for hundreds of years.
Kathy, that's just silly.
What? Really, Derek? This was you? You're playing on my one and only fear.
Happy Halloween, babe.
But what about the radio broadcast?
You weren't listening to a radio. Just a CD I got a friend to record. He was just pretending to be a newsreader.
Unbelievable.
Also got him to flash the lights and shake the door. Okay, Keith, you don't have to overplay your role. Stop shaking the thing and come in.
What's going on now? Another friend?
Kathy, this isn't me.
Really?
Kathy, I swear, this isn't me. Keith, if this is you, stop it! It's not funny! It's not funny!
Sorry I'm late. Do you still want me to help pull that prank on Kathy? Hello? Derek, are you here? Where have they both gone to, then? And what are these two pumpkins doing here?
What's wrong with a word like death? Such a taboo said under your breath. Changed, mangled, altered for the weak. It's just another word. Get over it, you freak. A word to describe an action, it shouldn't offend. But it does, and I feel sorry for you, that you can't handle such an innocent term, all I hear is boo-hoo. Why can't you say a word like death, so frail to even say under your breath? Passed away, put to sleep, these are phrases that make me weep. Often said to soften the blow, time to meet your maker, come on, let's go. Just say what you mean, don't beat around the bush, what the hell are you expecting everyone to hush? Why are you so scared of a word like death? Like a small, frightened child, you say it under your breath. You won't conjure the Reaper. The bogeyman won't arrive. Just say the bloody word and get on with your lives. Death is just a word. Nothing more, nothing less. It's certainly not evil, no matter how much you stress. To be scared of a thing so small is something I can't comprehend. Death is only descriptive. It just describes the end.
through space, drifting toward eternity. Mystical sparks encircled by loneliness and cold darkness. Are you afraid? So are a lot of other people. One of the reasons witchcraft has survived through the ages is because man's need to coerce destiny and subdue the fear within has never subsided. Witchcraft attempts to deceive, cajole, and otherwise disturb natural inclination and occurrences. Witches know about the universal energy of which all things are part. You, the stars, the trees, the rocks, the gods. We know how to tune into this energy and use it. A witch is a psychic female who, with magical secrets and sheer force of will, makes things happen. I'm a witch. My mother is a witch. My grandmother is a witch, and my grandmother's great-grandmother was a witch. I'm a sixth-generation witch. With magic, I control energy. With magic, I can help you become a power. With enchantments, spells, and charms, you will soon be able to rearrange the law and order of all things. Orgies are ritualistic energy exchanges that provide the concentration of power needed for spell casting. Witches and wizards crave energy, and in fact are very much addicted to it in all forms. And there's a special kind of energy derived from uniting with another. And so spellcasters do a tremendous amount of uniting. We know that a mystical bond exists between lovemakers. This bond is able to attract all sorts of good luck and success. An energy exchange celebration that is offered as a token to the gods will liberate your soul and expand your consciousness. You will be better able to absorb the raw energy of the cosmos and convert it quickly to your needs after you have participated in a glorious celebration of love. Enchanters need orgies. The orgy will help you generate the electric and magnetic impulses you'll need in order to cast spells. But the best time for an orgy is during the dark of the moon, or when the moon is full, and again at the times of the equinoxes. These are periods when the Earth is surrounded by wild vibrations, and when if the orgy is successful, you will be able to slip easily into the fifth dimension of fantasy, gather what you need, and return stronger and ready to create your destiny. Traditional orgies have always consisted of either 9, 11, 13, or 22 guests. You're able to double the amount, triple it, increase it 7 times over. But you must never invite one more or one less. There's a reason for the strict discipline in witchcraft. And if you deviate from the rule, you could unleash powerful and unfortunate evil forces. So plan your orgy with care. Invite only a specified number of guests. To begin the orgy, all guests must stand in a circle. Each must light a red candle and dedicate the flame to the god Pluto. And then let the place be filled with laughter. And as the queen witch rings a pewter bell 3 times, psychic inspiration will direct the group activities.
One day, you're going to die. Your life will just end right then and there. You will be no more. It probably won't be pretty, like in the movies or in fairy tales. Maybe something extraordinary will happen. But probably not. Sometimes people have enough energy to say or do something meaningful right before they die. And that's nice. But that is uncommon. Usually, people just die. And you're going to die too. Some people will say nice things to make you comfortable before you die. Other people will tell you wild stories that say that you're not actually going to die. But those people are only nice, not honest. Because you really are going to die. There are many ways to think about dying, different stories to tell, and different things to think dying is like. But death happens to people in the same way, no matter which way they think about it. Everyone dies and is no more. Because we are so good at making up stories and believing them, you may even begin to experience dying in a way that fits one of your stories. And that is okay. But then you'll die and it won't matter what story you had. When you die, you won't even be able to see if your story was right or not, because there will be no story and no person to believe or compare stories. You will be dead. You won't go anywhere. And you will not even stay in the same place, because there will be no you. There won't be anything, and there won't even be nothing, because you won't be there to feel like there's nothing. There won't be forever, because you won't even be there to feel like it's forever. You will be dead. And you won't even be able to think, gee, I'm dead, because you can't even think or feel or be anything besides dead when you're dead. Death can happen at any time. Sometimes little babies die. Sometimes mommies and daddies die. And when people get too old, after they have had a lot of life, they die. And you're going to die too. Sometimes it hurts when you die. And other times, people don't feel a thing. But we only know this from what people say or do right before they die. After you die, you won't feel anything. Not even pain. But people who are still alive when you die might hurt because you are gone. And that is okay. People love other people, and usually it hurts when people we love die. We even comfort ourselves with those stories that the dead person is not really dead. And that is okay too. But of course, everyone dies. And you will too. When you say, I want this, or I feel this, you are talking about yourself. You might think that yourself is different from the rest of the world, or you might think that you are just a little part of the world. But when you die, yourself dies, and so does your view of the world. So you won't have a world or a self or any thoughts about either. You just won't exist. When you die, you won't be sad anymore. You won't worry anymore. You won't care about anything or want anything. You won't be able to enjoy being dead, though. Because you won't be anything, only dead. That is why you should love life. There are lots of things in life that seem bad. But since life only happens once, and there is only one you, love life while you can, no matter what happens. If you feel sad, at least you can feel sad. If you are worried, at least you can be worried. You exist. You are alive. If you love life this way, when it comes time to die, you will be happy because death is the perfect end to life. Life is only good because death ends it. So live and love life, because you don't even know how, when, or why, but since you're alive, you're going to die.
been listening to the Cornucopia Broadcasting Halloween Special. Good night, and good luck.